Podcast is back. Yes, that's right. We had our Friday edition randomly just a few days ago with Parrish. Kind of came out of nowhere. If you missed that one for whatever reason, go back and listen. Still plenty relevant. And here we go, recording the next one on a Tuesday. And we're going to be kind of getting back into the flow of the podcast schedule going forward. And soon enough, it'll be on that 3 times a week rotation, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, before you know it, because the hoop season is really quickly approaching. We're well less than a month away from official practices starting, and I know that just because NFL and college football are taking over, it doesn't seem like basketball is all that close, but it really sneaks up on you. So today, we're going to touch on a lot of stuff with a topic that people love to hate, and that's the NCAA in general. I'm bringing on John Infante, who is, for my money, whatever little that is worth, the most well-informed, well-reasoned, rational, intelligent source of NCAA interpretation on Twitter. And John's been on the podcast before. He's a wild and crazy guy. He's got this smooth tone to him, this very docile aura, but don't let that fool you. He really knows how to get down and party. I can just tell. So he's coming on the pod today, and we're going to hit on a whole bunch of stuff. The Duke news just came down, so we're going to start with that first. But before we get to that, John, thanks for coming back on. And I appreciate you doing this podcast with full transparency, as always. Soccer going on in the background, so there could be some hooliganism happening at any moment. And it's a chance I'm willing to take. How you doing, man?
Good. We're just, you know, I was just following on Twitter, so it won't be spontaneous outbursts, but you know, you're smart with the podcast. It's like the players, you know, you don't jump right into 5 practices a week. You know, you do weights, individuals for a while and then get back into it.
Exactly. I'm getting back into my flow here, as it were. Okay, let's go right into it, and we're going to hit Duke first. The Duke news, if for some reason you're listening to this podcast, coming home from work, and you didn't really get a chance to check the interwebs today on Tuesday, is that Lance Thomas has settled with the jeweler who was suing him for defaulting on a loan payment that was worth nearly $70,000. Okay, so what this basically means is that it seems unlikely anything will come from this case, which we would never have even known about if Thomas didn't default to begin with, and this jeweler finally was like, no, we're not having any more of this. We're suing you. So as it stands, it looks like Duke won't get hit. So, John, can you just talk a little bit why? Like, everyone wants blood with Duke, okay? Everyone mm-hmm. wants Duke to fall. Specifically, people reference the Corey Maggette case, and a lot of younger people don't quite understand what happened there. We've got it detailed on our site. I don't want to rehash everything here, but here we have a second time where it looks like a Duke player might have really been helped out with some big-time money. Maybe. I'm not saying he did. It just, from outward appearances, it looked like it could have been like that. And here, it really looks like nothing's going to happen to Duke. Is that right? And if so, why?
It makes it a lot harder because, as a lot of people may or may not know, the NCAA lacks subpoena power, which basically means they can't go drag random people off the street, put them under oath, and then throw them in jail if they lie. So unless you're a student athlete or a coach that wants to continue coaching or an administrator wants to continue working in college athletics, the NCAA really doesn't have a means to make you talk. So when it came out that there was, you know, the potential of, some violation, which could have been questions like, why did Lance Thomas get a $60,000, $70,000 loan to buy jewelry? And where did he come up with $30,000 in the first place? You know, the people looking for blood might have been, you know, had cause for hope, because if he wasn't going to settle, then this was going to go to court, and those court documents, you know, would have been open. The information about why he got this loan and potentially what the jeweler knew about where he got the money would have been a matter of public record that the NCAA could have used to build a case. Or on the flip side, the jeweler might have considered talking to the NCAA as a means to pressure Thomas into settling if it hadn't have ended so quickly. This, by the way, you know, you bring up the Corey Maggette. This is basically exactly what happened in the Reggie Bush case, except Reggie Bush didn't settle. So had Reggie Bush settled that case with Michael Michaels and Lloyd Lake earlier, maybe, you know, USC's in the same situation where there's reports about this. Everybody kind of has a sense of what happened, but the NCAA is never able to get any sort of hard information or talk to anyone involved.
what about the criticism and the cynical point of view that the NCAA won't investigate this further? Why, you know, people will say, listen, it's something there. It's a smoking gun. Okay, so they settled. But why won't the NCAA still, you know, get on its feet and really dig in and try and discover something here? Why pragmatically will that not happen?
Well, one thing we do is that it might. I know a lot of people basically from, you know, going back to the Reggie Bush case, from the time the original Yahoo report came out until we heard that USC was going to go in front of the Committee on Infractions for the violations, I think a lot of people believe the NCAA wasn't doing anything with it while they were, you know, had people on the ground in Los Angeles from time to time. They were interviewing people. USC was cooperating. At least the NCAA said they met their obligation to cooperate. So it could be that the NCAA works really hard on this for the next year or two until the statute of limitations is up and they just can't get anything. And at that point, you know, Duke may come out and say the statute of limitations is passed, the NCAA didn't find anything, we're in the clear, or they might not bring any attention to it. But the other option might be, you know, they only have so many people working in enforcement. If they have other priorities, you know, cases that can be moved forward easily, it may just be that they get as much information from Duke and, you know, the people that they can still talk to, like the Duke coaches or administrators that were there around the time, and find out what they know. And then they may just have to wait and hope that something else about this comes out. If no one else is going to talk to them.
Okay, let's move to Carolina, and I'm not done with the Duke thing. We'll address both of these schools together after we're done talking about the very layered and often misinterpreted situation with North Carolina. And I do find it quite interesting and just funny, and sure, maybe even coincidental, that Duke and Carolina both came under some scrutiny here and speculation, suspicion, whatever you want to call it, with rule breaking in two different areas. Obviously, with Carolina, it appears to be so much more football than basketball based, but UNC is known for its hoops more than its football, and it's known to be an incredible academic university. So there's irony dripping off this story everywhere. But there's been a lot of criticism that the NCAA basically has given up with North Carolina, has ruled there's nothing to be seen here, there was no academic fraud. And I've written a couple of things on the blog about why that's not necessarily the case. But John, can you really lay out here for everyone that thinks this case is over and that UNC has already gotten off scot-free, why that's not the case, and just how this is being misinterpreted by people and has been for really a few weeks now, if not longer?
So a couple of weeks ago, I don't remember if it was last Friday or the Friday before, the way it was reported was that the NCAA announced that there were no violations in the North Carolina academic fraud investigation, which is not what happened at all. What happened was North Carolina announced that following one of four separate investigations that the university is doing into these no-show independent study courses, that they turned that one of four investigations over, and the NCAA said there were no violations here. So there's certainly the chance that one of the other three investigations will turn up something. And we can certainly go into why there's still a very good chance that there will be no violations in the North Carolina case. But as of right now, what the school basically announced is after the first quarter, we're still ahead. And it's really nothing more than that.
Right. Okay. Which is really key for people to remember here. Now, and if I didn't mention at the top, and that's my bad, but John has worked in compliance at two universities in the past and now writes for athleticscholarships.net, where he continues his work with the bylaw blog and really kind of is able to expand more on a lot of these topics. So I definitely suggest you go and read all his work. And if you got this podcast by way of the blog, you'll see I've linked a couple of his most recent pieces. In your opinion, do you think the first report that North Carolina handed over to the NCAA, I know you have no way of really knowing this, but do you think they would have handed over the easiest thing for the NCAA to say, you know, okay, you're good, or you think they would have done the toughest work first?
I think they probably would have gotten the first report that they got. North Carolina has shown that it in this whole thing, because remember, they're currently under probation on football for a host of other violations.
Right. Exactly.
Which included an academic fraud component.
Yes. People seem to be forgetting to mention that, by the way, in their columns and just general reactions.
So, and the big difference now is that the basketball is now being drawn into it, which is why this has gotten a lot more of its attention. But they've showed this really willingness to move beyond this. They're not the sort of the school that wants to dig in and fight at every turn. You certainly don't see, especially amongst their fans, even this idea of maybe that you saw with USC, where the fans really wanted to dig in and they want every appeal. They want lawsuits. They want, they want USC to march down over to Indianapolis and take control and right wrongs and, you know, dispense justice their way. But you're not really seeing that with North Carolina. They want to move forward. Now, if the 2009 basketball title is at risk, that might be a different story. But they've shown this idea of, we want to get past this. We kind of want to just move on from this. Maybe not sweep it under the rug so much, but yes, we screwed up. Let's move forward. So the idea that as soon as they got a report, they were going to send it to the NCAA is pretty consistent with how they've operated both in the original investigation and then as this has come out, that they've been pretty proactive. I mean, the fact that you see this allegation now, you know, that the school has taken a lead and done, you know, four separate investigations show that there's certainly a commitment to the school to, you know, at the very least look like they're trying to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, generally, you know, when you have a faculty and university administration involved in these type of internal investigations, they're really serious about knowing what happened. So I don't know if it was necessarily, you know, the easiest or the hardest, but it would certainly be consistent with how North Carolina has operated, that they had the first report and they turned it over to the NCAA as soon as it was done, whether it was the one most likely to exonerate them or the one most likely to incriminate them.
You recently wrote about a rejected NCAA proposal that makes this case more complex. Can you summarize what that piece is about and how it relates to Carolina right now?
So in 2008, the NCAA, one of the cabinets of the NCAA, which are groups in the NCAA made up of people who work at the schools, who study issues and propose a lot of the legislation in NCAA, proposed rules about standards for non-traditional courses, which include online courses and independent study courses. And those proposals said that courses needed to have regular interaction, amongst some other requirements, between the student and the teacher throughout the duration of the course in order to count the class as progress towards your degree when you complete it, and then towards full-time enrollment while the student athlete is enrolled in it. So had that passed, then the fact that there were no-show courses would have been a fairly clear violation, or at the very least, the status of the eligibility of the athletes would have been clear, that they would have been enrolled in courses which did not meet the requirements to be used towards full-time enrollment or progress towards degree. You would have gone back and calculated whether or not they still would have been eligible if you took those courses out. And if ineligible players were used, then North Carolina would have to vacate games up to and including, NCAA tournament games. Now, the proposal wasn't going to become effective until after North Carolina's 2009 national championship, so that wouldn't have been at risk. But certainly anything after that would have been much easier. So now it's more this kind of murky question of academic fraud rather than does it meet the specific checklist of this bylaw.
And the question of academic fraud really is rooted in this interesting scenario where, okay, so a lot of people see we got football players and we've got basketball players, and we've seen reporting that really strongly indicates that these kids were enrolled in classes where they could have arguably not even showed up, or if they did show up, maybe their grades were, you know, enhanced just because of a, I don't even know if I want to call him a rogue professor. He was the head of this specific department. But the reason why, and if I'm wrong here at all, please correct me, but the reason why it's going to be hard for the NCAA to really pin some serious stuff, so to speak, on Caroline is that we're seeing that the classes were not only taken by players, student athletes, whatever you want to call them, basketball players, football players. There were also regular students in the class. So can you lay out why, because of that, there's a precedent set there that the NCAA can't really put its hand into that machine, because then it's dealing with something that deals with regular students that could have gotten academic benefits, and it wasn't necessarily players that were getting the benefit, right? So as far as the NCAA is concerned, it's really more of an academic and institutional thing, and that's where it really gets all murky, doesn't it, John?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you kind of look at some of these things on a continuum, it starts to make more sense why it gets difficult for the NCAA. I mean, look at, for instance, the Harvard cheating scandal. I think, you know, when you look at the response of the school and you look at who was involved, that doesn't strike you as being an athletic scandal per se, because you had this just widespread cheating in this class, and the fact that it's looped in a couple of basketball players and now a couple of baseball players looks to be just a simple numbers thing, that, you know, there's X percentage of students at Harvard are student athletes, which means, you know, in any class, X percentage of them should be athletes too. And if an entire class cheats, then you're probably going to catch an athlete or two.
Right.
Whereas certainly if you go and you find out that, you know, a school has specifically set up no-show independent study or online courses for athletes that are, you know, other students are blocked from enrolling in them, and they are exclusively for athletes, and the administration is working with the athletic department to generate these courses when athletes need them to be eligible, and the NCAA found any evidence of that, that would be, I mean, that would get into one of the most serious academic fraud investigations the NCAA has ever had. But when it's in the middle is when it gets murky, when it does appear to be that it was largely athletes, but not exclusively athletes. So it doesn't look like this was specifically generated, unless, of course, you know, they brought athletes into it in order, or non-athletes into it in order to shield the athletes, which I guess is possible, but would be another element you would need to get some evidence of if you were going to punish the school for it. And the other issue is, you know, what we think of academic fraud is, again, on another type of continuum. So I think when we see, like, academic dishonesty, players getting papers written for them, getting answers to tests early, you know, improper assistance, plagiarism, that sort of thing, that is pretty clearly things we see as violations, especially when the athletic department is the one providing the assistance to athletes. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, there's things like clustering athletes in majors, or athletes being, you know, directed to courses which are just simply easier, professors that have grading scales that are more forgiving, or professors that will let them skip more class in order to, you know, not get punished for going on road trips and things like that. And the idea of independent study courses that aren't really well regulated is, again, somewhere in the middle. So it is one of these kind of Pandora's boxes or precedents or whatever you want to call it, with that if the NCAA says this is not allowed, then the NCAA is sort of staking a claim to regulating how independent study courses are run, which is problematic because it gets at the heart of kind of institutional autonomy that universities very jealously guard their ability to educate people and research things and run their courses the way they want to. And at the same time, this is something like we just talked about, which the NCAA members specifically said they did not want the NCAA to be involved in.
Right, and we're going to move on to eligibility stuff in just a second here, but wrapping this up, it's just such a difficult topic to grope, so to speak, for the NCAA, because you're dealing with things, you know, there is no doubt about it, programs, regardless of sport, by the way, that get players in certain kind of classes because it's going to keep their GPA is higher, keep them more eligible, and that's fine. But it's an interesting slope, and I definitely see the perspective, and I might even agree with it that when you look at it from afar, and if you see a class and you see 17 athletes in a 30-person class got passing grades and did no work for it, it's like, well, there should be some sort of accountability here that the NCAA should be able to punish. But at the same time, it would set a precedent with that I just don't think is possible to even keep up with going forward. And I say this as someone who considers academic fraud probably to be the worst kind of cheating that can be done at the college level. Like academic fraud, like if you told me a certain player on a title team, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, or whatever, a key player was straight up given 5 fake grades to keep him eligible, and that kept him on the team that won a title, that bothers me so much more than if that player was given $80,000 over the course of 2 years. But that's just me. I want to wrap up one quick thing on Duke and UNC with you here.
Mm-hmm.
People, and it's just about the NCAA and not having action. So right now UNC is digging into its own records, and I made the analogy that it's basically the NCAA is digging through its own closet. UNC is digging through its own closet, and the NCAA is just standing in the hallway kind of just like checking the stuff and make sure, just keeping an eye on it or whatever. For people that might not be able to pick up on the differences, why is the NCAA doing that with UNC, and how is it so clearly different between Duke? Because I just want to make sure people listening to this podcast realize that these are two very, very different circumstances, and just because they're Duke and UNC doesn't mean the NCAA can't attack it from the same perspective.
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that there's probably different groups working on these two issues. UNC's issues are more kind of fall under like general enforcement of NCAA rules, whereas what happened with Lance Thomas and Duke might be something that the basketball focus group or the agents gambling and amateurism group, which are kind of, you know, specialty groups that focus on obviously amateurism violations in basketball, specifically recruiting and agent activity in basketball. So those two groups are known for being a little more, proactive or aggressive, depending on your point of view, in how they do investigations. So they tend to be on the ground more at schools. They tend to be out in the communities more, checking on things. I guess you could call it looking for violations, following up on information. So, it's possible with some of the kind of fact-finding work that those groups have done that they have more information about this jeweler who we know has a clientele that focuses on professional athletes. They may know more about this. I mean, and one thing with the pace of NCAA investigations is the NCAA may be preparing to hammer Duke right now, and we might not know it for a couple months while they get all their, you know, ducks in a row.
Okay.
So that could be happening. It's not. And, you know, with most of these cases, I think you'd say, you know, figure out when the statute of limitations is about to end. And that's when you say they've gotten off scot-free, because something else could always come out. But with UNC, it's more, you know, about the institutional policies rather than NCAA rules. So the institution is going to kind of be more the expert on whether their policies are being followed. And in a lot of cases, you know, when you have violations that don't involve a lot of third parties, as long as you're doing a good enough job and you're keeping the NCAA in the loop, the NCAA will kind of let you take point on your own investigation, and then step in the places where either they feel more work needs to be done or the school is not able to do the type of work that it wants done.
Right. And then that's where obviously schools putting their own punishments on themselves come into play, something that we've seen more and more of, or at least it's been more in the public consciousness in the past decade. Okay, let's move on to talk about eligibility of incoming freshmen. It's been a pretty big deal in the off season, and it's garnered kind of individual flash headlines. I don't think that it's been a continual narrative that anyone's really taken on a big picture kind of thing, and maybe we should have at CBSSports.com over the summer, and maybe we still will. For all I know, Goodman's like written a column already and just hasn't told me. But most recently we saw two players that went to Notre Dame Prep, which is located in Maryland, ruled ineligible. Sam Cassell's kid was going to go to Maryland, and a guy by the name of Miles Davis, yes, Miles Davis, although spelled with a Y instead of an I, going to Xavier. And they didn't qualify, despite the fact that they took classes and credits that still amounted to the same requirements as other players that had gone to Notre Dame Prep that are still playing. For instance, Kem Birch, who went to Pitt last year, he's actually going to play for Vegas this year. Could be a pretty decent piece at Vegas and help them be a arguably Final Four-worthy team. So this has drawn the ire of Sam Cassell, most notably, who's gone out and killed the NCAA. But it's not just those two, John. We've also seen the Ricky Lito situation at Providence. He's a partial qualifier. Rodney Purvis did just qualify at NC State. Top 20 kid, makes them ACC favorites, most likely, at least to me. And there's been even more aside from that. So overall, big picture question here is it just me, or are we seeing more of these cases hanging in limbo for months now leading up into a season with freshmen? Is this year an outlier, or has this been consistently something that's grown and grown and grown over the past 6-7 years, in your opinion? And two, is this it's obviously a case-by-case basis, but how much similarity or difference is there, you know, overall with these freshmen that are coming in and trying to qualify?
As far as a trend, I do think it's getting the scrutiny is definitely getting higher. I don't know necessarily whether these, you know, particular, or whether, you know, this the time frame is getting longer generally. Almost always when there's a delay like this, it's because the information isn't there. Once the NCAA gets the information, I mean, it's pretty consistent where the staff, if you're at, you know, the first kind of level of review, meets on a regular basis and then renders their decision within like a week afterwards. So typically once you have everything that the staff wants, you are, you know, generally 2 to 3 weeks out from a decision. The trouble is getting to the point where you have all the information that either the NCAA staff, or if you're going on appeal, the committee of people who work at NCAA schools is satisfied that you have all the information. But the scrutiny is definitely going up, and part of it has to do with the fact that when the NCAA Eligibility Center opened in 2007, it took all of the lists of approved high schools and core courses from the old NCAA Clearinghouse, which was run out of Iowa City by the ACT. But none of that stuff had ever been verified. So there's thousands of high schools. And well, the original idea of the clearinghouse was at least that everybody was working off the same sheet of music. Right. So it wasn't that Kentucky was approving a course that UNC wasn't. It's that Kentucky and UNC were both accepting the same possibly fraudulent course. Now there's a high school review team that actually digs in and makes sure that these courses are, you know, legitimate college prep high school courses, and that the schools that are offering degrees are legitimate high schools that are preparing kids for college. But there's a gigantic backlog, and they can only work through, I believe the last time I heard stats, it was something like 2, 3, maybe 4 high schools a day to get through the tens of thousands of high schools and the hundreds of thousands of courses, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of athletes who might take a course but take it in a manner that's not academically sound. So they might take an approved online course but work through it in, you know, a matter of hours. I mean, there's horror stories of kids submitting transcripts that say they've completed a semester of algebra in 1 minute, or, you know, a semester of English in 15 minutes. So there's definitely, you know, there's definitely scams being run, and, you know, a type of academic fraud, although a lot of this is just schools pushing kids through to graduation because they're under as much pressure to graduate kids and meet, you know, federal and state standards as the kids are to get eligible. So that scrutiny has gone up. I wonder, though, how much of it is the checking of you know, how much of the what appears to be that it's taking longer is that it's pretty well reported, because it really wasn't until a few years ago that there was really good reporting at all of who was eligible or not. I think most fans just noticed that a kid that they signed for some reason wasn't on the roster the next year. And now there's more of a reporting of who's been cleared, who's waiting, not just, you know, amongst the very top prospects, but, you know, pretty much everyone, every Division I prospect, if there's some sort of delay, somebody will make it known. And now I forgot the second question.
How about this? Which case do you think is of a kid not getting cleared? And we can go with someone this year, or if you want to go last year, the year before, if it's one that stands out. Which one did a kid not get cleared to play, and you thought it was the most unfair from the information you had?
Of the kids this year, I mean, the Cassell and Davis ones are the ones that are going to really kind of stick in people's craws. I certainly understand the two kids and their parents and, you know, even the schools are coming from. And there is something to say of, you know, grandfathering the courses in. The one thing I would say is you kind of, when you're wondering why the NCAA is doing something, when you're, you know, when fans or commentators are asking, why can't they just grandfather this in? I mean, you have to kind of think about what scam you would run if that were the case, which would be to put together a diploma mail, get it approved, and then just shuffle through as many basketball players you could until you got caught, and then claim, well, they already took the course before you invalidated it.
Right.
So, and that's what the NCAA is trying to combat by not kind of grandfathering in the courses. The other things, you know, I mean, a kid like Ricky Alito, who has bounced around to four high schools in 5 years and, you know, got his partial waiver to stay at Providence. I mean, maybe we'll see kind of more of that. And one thing that hasn't been really well understood about the new eligibility requirements that are coming in 2016 is if you fail to meet those, that's what happens to you. You're just not allowed to play. The current standards are going to remain, and that's going to be what is an athlete's required to get in order to practice and get a scholarship.
Okay.
So they're bringing back this idea of the partial qualifier as a regular thing rather than these partially approved waivers, which is what Lito got at Providence, and then which is was overturned on Rodney Purvis's appeal, because he won a full approval on appeal. So he was going to go to NC State and probably get a scholarship and practice, but not play until he won his appeal. And now he's considered like a full qualifier and able to play.
Okay.
So I think we're going to see more of that. It'll be interesting to see the response of the conferences, because one of the big culprits that's not really talked about is conference non-qualifier rules, which a lot of them basically say, if you enroll as a freshman and you're a non-qualifier, you are ineligible at all schools in the conference permanently.
Hmm.
And those tend to be very hard and fast. And that's what turns
which is, by the way, why Cassell's kids got to leave Maryland and go try and find somewhere else.
Correct, because he was in classes. It appears he was in classes, and as soon as you're in classes and trigger full-time enrollment, you're subject to that rule. But that's what's turning the NCAA's eligibility requirements into admissions requirements, because the school just can't keep the kids enrolled if they're not allowed to get aid, never allowed to play, never allowed to practice at the school. So that's why you're also seeing a couple of kids where it's not that they're being denied, it's that the reviews are taking so long and the schools are not letting them enroll, because if it goes wrong, they'll be ineligible. So they're having to reclassify a year because the school can't risk letting them into the school until the NCAA finishes clearing the kid.
Last question here. So you talk about these partial qualifiers, and yes, the storm coming off the coast in the future is this 2016 academic requirements for players to get into school, and that's something we will detail more and more on the site and on the podcast to come, but I'm not going to get into that today. But when you say partial qualifiers, you know, these kids are practicing for a year, but does that mean that they practice for a year and then they take their college courses, and what they, you know, what they essentially make up academic-wise means that in their sophomore year they're able to play full-time?
Yeah. The way it works is basically it's a required red shirt in your first year. So they're under all the same requirements as students who've come in and been cleared to play. So as long as they, you know, meet their hours, meet their GPA requirements, are, you know, students in good standing and everything, then they'll be cleared to play and they'll have the, you know, 4 years to play their four seasons having used their red shirt. It'll be a little different in 2016. They're going to be allowed to practice in the fall, and then they'll need to meet a slightly higher requirement of 9 hours to keep practicing in the spring. So they will have a slightly different requirement, but when it comes to them being cleared to play as sophomores, it's going to be the same as a freshman who came in and was fully cleared to begin with.
Interesting. Man, we are deep into this podcast, and we have not even touched on two more things I wanted to hit on. I almost feel like I should put them on the back burner here, because I know there's still going to be issues going forward, and I can get you back on in November or December. One was the oversigning issue in hoops, which you wrote on. And overall, just general, the NCAA wants to thin its rule book. I think we might put that off for a bit. But real quick here, in about 2 minutes or less, John, just you wrote, why is oversigning accepted in college basketball, whereas in college football, certainly in the past 3 years, so-called gray shirts have gotten a lot of scrutiny for a lot of coaches, Saban being one of them. And Patino in basketball is certainly an indicator of a coach that, without caution, will get his roster above the scholarship level of 13. So go ahead and wax on your piece a little bit and give us some opinion here on the oversigning issue in college hoops and why it's being met to a certain degree with, I don't know if acceptance is the right word, but just delayed fraught maybe. I don't know.
Well, I think it's certainly, you know, it's not the type of outrage that you see in football. I mean, it is a you know, big issue in football. I mean, to the point where the type of maybe commentator or writer who, you know, the guy on the college football beat who wants to treat it like the NFL beat is even still like, at this point, man, maybe these kids are getting a raw deal. You know, even if they're even, you know, the idea that the, you know, the kid's just not good enough or got hurt, now they're kind of being shuffled off the team to make room. And I think it's just really interesting that it happens in basketball, just like it happens in football. You know, there's not the websites like oversigning.com or the kind of oversigning advocates who are tracking this meticulously, so we don't have, you know, as good of numbers. Plus, it seems like the, you know, recruiting and transfer, you know, I think the idea of a transfer season in men's basketball, I mean, I know Goodman puts together the list, but at this point, when does he stop this year's list and start the next year's list if kids are going to be transferring halfway through September and trying to get into schools for this same fall semester?
Right.
And I think that's one of the big reasons that it's kind of masked this, is that, you know, a coach is much more likely to have 8 guys on scholarship come August than he is to have 14 or 15 like Louisville and Indiana had to deal with through the summer this year. So I do think it's an issue that needs to be kind of studied and looked at. I do think it is another factor is that you don't hear these things like kids gray shirting or freshmen getting their scholarship pulled right at the last minute because, you know, another kid qualified or another, you know, some student that they thought was going to gray shirt decided he wanted to come or something like that. So the outcomes tend to be that there's more transfers in basketball, and I think that's where that has kind of focused on, which is probably a whole podcast in and of itself. But I do think it's something that's it's worthwhile to start looking at it and maybe start asking whether some coaches or some areas are making it more of a routine. And if it starts to get a routine, then I do think we're starting to get into the same issues that we see in football, where we're no longer asking, you know, are there too many transfers, but kind of are some of these transfers the result of kids kind of being pushed out to make room for the new recruits?
Absolutely, and that is another podcast to itself, and we will obviously convene again to go more in depth. We're going to see stories like that happen throughout the next, you know, not even, you know, year to half year at most. So you can follow him on Twitter, John Infante. That is John with an H underscore I-N-F-A-N-T-E. And buddy, you were good again as usual. Appreciate you coming on, always dispelling the info out there on Twitter. Get back to your football, okay, man?
Always a pleasure.
All right, man. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much. We will be back later this week. At least we should. Doug Gottlieb, who's new to CBS Sports Network, he will be joining me on the podcast probably on Thursday. But keep an eye out for that, and we will talk to you soon. Thanks so much.